The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them, and not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Ride On Radio on KFAI 90.3 or streaming on the web at KFAI.org. My name is Emma, your host tonight, and today's guest is Ryan Rogers and his newly released book, Where the Green Light Shines, a 50-year odyssey from the boundary waters to the far north, a unique glimpse into the world of Arctic canoeing through the travels of Bob O'Hara. Ryan's vivid descriptions of the northern wilderness as traversed by eclectic paddlers, bush pilots, and historic characters. Then afterwards, in the next half hour, we will go into the archives and listen to a past episode. Thank you so much and stay tuned for Ride On Radio. Thank you so much. Today's guest is Ryan Rogers, the author of the newly released book, Where the Green Light Shines, a 50-year odyssey from the boundary waters to the far north. Thank you again for joining us today, Ryan.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Emma.
So just to give a good brief overview, I'm curious about you, Ryan, and your writing. Like, how did you get into writing? What kind of stuff do you like to write about? And then we'll talk about Bob O'Hara.
Well, I mean, I've been writing for 20 years now over that. I guess I started doing it on a regular basis while doing some extended travels some years ago. And I wound up meeting the main subject of this book while working on another writing project about a totally different topic. And somebody said, you got to talk to this guy, Bob O'Hara.
Yeah.
And we communicated via email, and he sent me an attachment to this email, which was a list of 50 years of canoe trips he'd taken. And it just eventually snowballed from there.
So have you ever met Bob in person, or was it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
We've met a number of times. We went on a trip to the Boundary Waters together that really kicked off the start of the writing of this book.
So, like, Bob O'Hara's just written a lot about, like, his 50-plus years of canoeing and everything else. So you had, like, access to those notebooks, correct?
Yeah, he loaned me his journals, which was essential. You know, he's done dozens of trips since the late... Well, his first Boundary Waters trip was in 1959, and then he started doing these far north trips in the 1960s. And he didn't have journals from all of those trips, but for most of the major far north trips, he did have journals, which he gave me access to. And I was also able to talk with other people who had been on his trips, and some of those folks loaned me their journals as well, which gave some necessary insight into these journeys that had happened so long ago.
So I'm always kind of curious what the trips were from the 50s, from like canoeing, which it doesn't seem like there was the start of big canoe expenditures, travel, and like the economy around outdoor recreation was the start. Was there like kind of interesting tidbits you learned? I was like, oh, in the 50s, canoeing was like this versus present day. Were you ever thinking about that?
Yeah, I mean, I always kind of took it for granted that we have this Minnesota Boundary Waters culture where, you know, it's just something people do. You go up to Ely or Grand Marais and maybe you bring your own gear. Maybe you get outfitted at one of the numerous outfitters. And, you know, that existed to a much smaller extent when Bob started doing these trips, but it really has grown into this unique Midwestern subculture that Bob really, you know, bore witness to the development of.
What I really liked about your books and like the way you describe a lot of Bob's trips, and there's a lot of trips, I was like, oh my gosh, it's just constant. Like, this guy's he just pretty much wants to live up there, was also how it ends up being spliced with like earlier expeditions, either from like British or Americas into Canada's, and like a lot of failed expeditions from these numerous like colonialistic pioneers, and that Bob kind of thought was fascinating. Do you think that was like a primary driver for a lot of his canoe expeditions was just like kind of almost recreate that pioneeristic past.
I don't think it was a primary driver, but it's sort of this, you know, there's this like this lore of the North, you know, it's this kind of legendary, mysterious place. And how, you know, why does it have that appeal? Why does it have that sort of, you know, sense of legend to it? And I think one of the reasons for that are these journeys that did happen there over time. And I mean, it definitely adds to the experience. And with Bob, I mean, on some of these trips, he was one of the first groups to have gone up there since these historic and sometimes tragic expeditions had unfolded.
I'm always like kind of baffled. Like I'm reading this and I'm like, why would I want to do this? It's like for Bob O'Hara, it just seems like just for the gain. Like, did he ever like have like a very good explanation of like why he kept going year after year after year and just kept pushing himself?
I mean, that's kind of the sense of the green light is this, you know, what is it that draws people up here, and what drew Bob up there? I mean, a lot of people, they, you know, they're just drawn to these outdoor experiences, and it's a hard thing to define exactly why. I mean, Bob, obviously, he just, you know, he just loved the experience of being out there. And, you know, I think it was a combination of things, the wildlife, just the, you know, the freedom of traveling on your own. And the scenery, and Bob always liked the camaraderie of the groups he was in as well.
Yeah, I kind of want to go back to like the camaraderie of like mostly these expeditions, where it is. I do think in American kind of culture, we do have like this lore of like, you know, the one guy going out, on these expeditions. But like really what I liked was like his interpersonal relationships with like the people that he has, or it's like where it just felt like he just picked a guy off randomly, or it's just like, hey, I want to go on this trip, does anybody else want to come with? And I'm just kind of baffled. It's like, oh, that's a long time to be with somebody that you just kind of met. You're eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner with them. And I'm really kind of struck by like the people that I even met along the way, whether it's like Canadian citizens, the Inuit, the locals within the areas as well, and like how it was a collaborative effort between many different parties to do these canoe expeditions. Was there something like insightful that you found about that?
Well, Bob, he partnered with over 100 people on these trips over a half century. And he's a little unusual for, but he was open to anyone joining. If you had the time and you had some money to pitch in for food supplies, you could join Bob on a trip, which, you know, there are these groups that go up and do these canoe trips, but usually they're sort of tight-knit friend groups who are probably really good paddlers. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about that. You don't want to be up there with somebody who doesn't know how to, you know, navigate through a rapids. But Bob never minded that. He always liked introducing people to the, you know, to the country, to the canoeing. And I mean, he never took any long trips by himself. I actually just heard from him yesterday morning, and he, every year since 1959, he's canoed and camped in the Boundary Waters. And this year he did continue that streak, and he was up there last month by himself at 85 years old, canoeing and camping. So he's not doing the far north trips anymore, but he's still doing what he can.
That's incredible. Do you think it's just going to be like that every year until he just physically can't do it anymore?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, there are not a lot of 85-year-olds in the Boundary Waters.
I'm enamored by that. I'm also just starstruck by his determination to keep canoeing. I'm always, there's like an excerpt in your book that I always found fascinating, because like what I think of like when I did like any kind of outdoor excursion, it's like field safety or things like that were always something in the back of my head. And it sounded like, would you say that Bob was open to like more devices for like SOS rescuing or GPS units, or was he just kind of very lower tech into these excursions?
He's always been willing to try new gear. You know, he's not into roughing it really. He has an expression. He has a number of catch lines, and one of them is, if you want to rough it, put sandpaper in the seat of your pants, which refers to his. You know, he doesn't want to rough it unnecessarily. He wants to be comfortable at camp. You know, he went from aluminum canoes to plastic canoes to, you know, lightweight Kevlar canoes. Now, on his most recent trips, he used these collapsible canoes that you can put in a backpack. So, no, he always likes trying the newest stuff just in hopes of, you know, making it easier and more efficient to travel.
Do you think he was, like, when you were going through these, when you're talking to Bob versus, like, when you're talking to other people who had other ideas about what was like to be with Bob, what was, like, kind of a, from, like, the way that other people talk about Bob, what was a kind of common denominator to talk about his personality or his demeanor while on these canoe trips?
Well, he's pretty famous for, you know, his spiciness. Like he definitely has a way of doing trips, and some people are okay with that. Other people, they'll do it once and they don't want to go again. I mean, that's the flip side of him being open to anyone going on his trips.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, he's going to do things his way. But I mean, one thing that he's proven over time is that his way was a safe, reliable way to go.
Mm-hmm. What was the, like when you were writing this book, were there like a lot of expeditions that you had to cut out because of the book? Because like going on 50 years of these journals seems like you just have like a totem stack of writing and things to talk about. Was it difficult to cut certain expeditions out if you did? What was like your decision to, it was like, oh, I'm going to include this one, but not include this one. Were there any ones that were kind of hard to cut or?
Yeah, it took a fair amount of time to figure out what to include and what not to include. I mean, there were some obvious trips, especially his formative ones, where really kind of crazy things happened and it made for exciting trips that I definitely wanted to include. Getting into the sort of the middle years, for a while he became obsessed with canoeing the Northwest Passage, mm-hmm. which was a really crazy idea. And so that became kind of the narrative peak of the book. And then after that, I mean, he was getting older and his trips became more numerous, but they became less ambitious and less mm-hmm. risky. So then I did a lot of condensing and that did take some time to figure out what trips were just going to get left out, what would get skimmed over, and what would be a focus of the narrative.
What I always thought of when Bob was talking about these trips was like his partners or like his girlfriends would get really upset about him going on these trips. And it sounded like he struggled to balance that a little bit because of like, do you think like his obsession just made it very difficult to have relationships outside of his like little canoe sphere a little bit? Because I was reading through that and I always think of the guys who go like climb El Capitan solo, and like the female partners are always like really upset or scared and things like that. Do you think because of these canoe trips he had a hard time with some relationships or not really?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
One thing I like about Bob's story is I spent a lot of time thinking about it, is he's kind of this conventional person who's living an unconventional life. I mean, Bob at heart he's a good Catholic boy. I mean, he was born in the early 1940s. He didn't have like huge aspirations. His thought was he was going to get married, he's going to have a bunch of kids, he was going to live a regular life, but he really became obsessed with this canoeing thing. And in that sense, he didn't get everything he wanted. He focused so hard on this canoeing that really became the driving force of his life. And he never did get married. His the relationships he had years ago, the main one ended directly because of a trip. And after that, he was, you know, he remained a bachelor.
Do you think it sounded like he's a really big proponent, though, of outdoor recreation and teaching as well? Does he still a partnership with outfitters teaching younger folks like when he was in Boy Scouts or?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's an educator. He was a high school teacher and he's long been involved with various camps, outdoor education places, the Boy Scout camp up by the Boundary Waters Summers Canoe Base. He's been involved with Wolf Ridge Environmental Learning Center for a long time. And I know he has some involvement with the YMCA camps up there, Widgiewagon and Minogian. And he's he's always been a big proponent of introducing kids to the Wilds in hopes of, you know, it's good for them. And also it ultimately, those kids will be the ones who will choose whether or not to protect the wilderness in the future.
How does he feel about the boundary waters now currently and for environmental conservation? Would you say he was a big environmental conservationist along with his canoe trips, or do you think like this that just kind of goes hand in hand?
Yeah, I mean, I would say Bob's an environmentalist. You know, he's always, I know he's against the mine up there. I recall asking him a few years ago whether, you know, do you think the mine can happen without pollution? And his answer was a resolute no. He's had other environmental efforts. He was involved in founding Friends of Crex Meadow, which is a nonprofit over in Wisconsin. He's always highly valued nature and the creatures that live there.
I'm always kind of curious, every time I get like a nonfiction book like this, I love the photography the photos or the images. How was it to acquire some of these images and just kind of picking through? It's like, oh, I want to include this, I don't want to include this. I think my favorite image in this book is of his Volkswagen, and there's like that giant canoe that looks like it's just going to tip over the entire van. It's on page 74. It's right before the fourth chapter. It's one of my favorite images, I think, because my aunt and uncle, they did a lot of canoe trips in the 70s on the Finger Lake region in New York, and they had a little Volkswagen buggy, but like the canoe was just bigger than the car itself.
We had a ton of images to choose from. I mean, Bob has an incredible collection of 10,000 or more slides. A lot of them are slides. And then these other people on the trips many times were taking photos as well. So it was, there was just an abundance of imagery to choose from. Excuse me. And Bob has always been a Volkswagen guy. His first car was a Beetle, which, he was going to get a Scout, which I guess is some kind of little truck, years ago. Yeah. And he went in to buy the Scout, and he brought his canoe paddle to make sure the paddle would fit in the vehicle, but did not. So instead he bought a Volkswagen because the canoe paddle would slide in there. And he bought VW vans for many years until they quit becoming available here. And I don't know what he's driving now, but he for years he loved his red VWs.
I'm curious, did you ever personally go on like a lot of these Arctic trips canoeing? Like, what is your relationship to canoeing?
I mean, I love to canoe. I have never paddled in the far north. You know, I would like to someday. I mean, especially all this time thinking about these rivers, it's a whole other world up there. You know, it's just like, it often seems like the world is all developed and built over, but I mean, there still is a vast wilderness in Canada going toward the North Pole. I mean, maybe someday.
I'm always, did you think, like in coordination a lot with these trips with Bob, I'm always thinking of like outdoor recreationists and like the people that he met, like a lot of surveyors, biologists, people like that. Did he ever have like a favorite, like a person, like one of his favorite stories to tell, particularly about any of these canoe trips with people? I don't know if I'm phrasing that right, but did he ever have like a favorite story to tell, I guess is what I'm asking.
When I first met Bob and I wrote a couple articles on him, and the two stories in particular that really hooked my interest were one in 1967, his first trip to Hudson Bay when he accidentally canoed over a waterfall, and that kind of blew my mind a little bit, and it worked out fine. And then two in 1969 on his first trip, like to the true far north, he led this trip, and it was, you know, it was through this tundra wilderness, and eventually him and his team, they were trapped. They couldn't paddle anymore because there was still ice on the lake. And so these guys are out there, and it's summer's wearing on, and they're stuck in camp, and they're running out of food because the river's blocked with ice. And things were getting really fairly dire until they ran into an Inuit guide leading a Canadian biologist, and the two groups camped together. And, you know, I'm sure they enjoyed each other's company as a diversion from what was going on. And eventually the Inuit guy, his name was Barnabas, who became a longtime friend of Bob. He
Barnabas went out and shot them a caribou, and so they, you know, they were living off the land for a short period of time, and eventually they were able to get out. But those two stories in particular, I thought were pretty wild. And there was, I'll tell you one more, where Bob met up with these two Canadian paddlers after all these guys had finished their respective trips for the year. This was back in the 70s, and they decided to take a freighter out of this tiny community of Baker Lake out to Hudson Bay because they wanted to visit this town none of them had ever seen before. And so they arranged to ride on this freighter ship that's bringing the town's annual supplies. They ride it for I don't know, a day or two, and they reach this remote little settlement on Hudson Bay, and it's at night. You know, it's kind of the Arctic gloaming twilight, and they're expecting somebody to come pick them up and give them a ride in a boat back to shore, but nobody's picking up the radio back on the shore. So the captain of the ship says they have to lower their canoes into Hudson Bay, climb down rope ladders, and paddle away. And that's what they did. And then their story continued to get a little sticky from there. And of course, they eventually made it back. But it's things that they're kind of hard to imagine living through.
I'm always kind of baffled that Bob like goes through like the one of especially with Barnabas, and I'm like, you had a near-death experience, and why would you want to go back out again? But it's just like he just keeps doing it every year. Does he ever get like scared? Do you ever think he got scared on these trips? Or like does he ever mention about like any sort of fear of like, hey, this is gonna be my last trip because I might not make it back?
You know, Bob, he doesn't really talk a lot about his emotions, in his recollections, nor in his journals at the time. His journals are pretty terse to the point, you know, we traveled so many miles today. This is what we had for dinner. Sometimes you have to read between the lines, like on his most arduous trip in 1976, his journal entries get very short for this period of time when they're again trapped by ice and running out of food and stuck on the Arctic Ocean. And like he'll talk about like maybe he had a headache or he didn't sleep very well because his stomach was upset. And that's that to me, those were the flags of when he was really, really scared and stressed out. And then talking to other people who had been on those trips who are more, you know, I don't know, upfront about their feelings of anxiety was also another way to really home in on when things truly got hairy.
Do you think he was like in these novels, like was it pretty difficult? Like when you first started, it's like, okay, he was feeling this, but they were pretty, you said terse. Did his writing like ever change? Like when he started to, have a little bit more journals as the years went on, it's like, oh, it got a little bit more, like his writing was a little bit more descriptive, or was his writing pretty consistent, his kind of style pretty consistent throughout all these journals?
It was actually the reverse. In his earlier journals, he would put a little more into the descriptions and the interactions with people. And as the years went on, they became more and more a recount of logistical details.
Oh, that's interesting. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean, I guess he just got the habits down. You know, I know at one, I would suspect at one point in time he had hoped to document his trips more thoroughly in terms of both writing and photography. And I know he told me a number of times that he's not a writer. He doesn't use adjectives was his description of it. So I would kind of think maybe in the beginning he thought he would do something with these journals, but then he decided he didn't really, writing really wasn't for him, so he just stick to the bullet points for, you know, posterity's sake.
I was thinking of like John Wesley Powell's, like when he writes about his descriptions when he did this first expeditions along the Colorado River, and like how very lyrical and kind of very descriptive he describes the canyons in contrast to, I'm guessing, Bob O'Hara's like very bullet point, like we did this, we did this, we did this, and I saw this, and I saw this. So I was gonna kind of think of like in a contrast with that. Do you think he was like, why do you think he was like his motivation to journal was just like keep track of everything in like kind of a mechanical sort of way?
I
Or was
don't
he?
know. I mean, a lot of people on these sort of ambitious and unusual trips do journal, I think, because, you know, they are aware that what they're doing is significant and deserves to be documented just because it's something that, I mean, in some of Bob's river descents, he was the first modern party to go down these rivers. So, I mean, there's that sense of posterity of creating a record that could be of use later.
But he did always journal on his big trips, his Boundary Waters trips, not on those, but on his big annual Canadian trip, he would.
I'm kind of curious, what does he think now that he has a book written about him in all these journals? Did he ever expect that to happen? Was he kind of surprised by the offer or the idea? Like, what was his approach towards, like, oh, here's Ryan going to write about my expeditions?
You know, I would suspect that he had hoped in the past and from time to time that that there would be a book about his trips. Again, he never said so directly, but I would guess
at one point in time he had hoped to write one. And actually, in some of the ways, like he phrased recollections, it seemed to me that he'd structured pieces of his story in his mind in sort of a narrative form. Like, I remember him telling me about on his first trip to Hudson Bay and how he saw the bay. He thought this was going to be like a one-time trip to the end of the world, pretty much. But then once he got there, he realized that this was not the end of the world. This was the beginning of the world. Mm-hmm. And just the way that he had processed that in his mind, it was like, you know, it's like he had built a narrative outline already, which, you know, made things easier for me.
One last question before you read a beautiful excerpt from your book. Does Bob, like, what is Bob's vision for canoeing now for future generations? He's still active. Does he have, like, oh, I want this to happen for the future generations in terms of either outdoor recreation, environmental conservation? Does he still expect there to be more canoe trips like this? Because he's 85 now, right? What does he expect for, like, future generations to preserve the Boundary Waters?
Yeah, I mean, he's still, you know, he doesn't have a lot of money. He still donates to these camps. I know he's a big believer in a, you know, kind of a moment of softness. Usually he's kind of a gruff guy. But I recall we were camping together in the Boundary Waters, and he had like this moment where he started, I wouldn't say gushing, but really like talking passionately about how kids deserve to have this experience, this exposure to the outdoors, just because, you know, again, it's hard to define these merits of wilderness experience, but once you know them, it becomes kind of a key thing for a lot of people. And he does remain supportive of young people doing trips. Just, I think it was last summer, there were some groups of, you know, college age kids, and they were going up to Hudson Bay, and it's sort of this rite of passage to stop by Bob's house and ask him about, you know, ask him for information. Yeah. Which he has a ton of, and he's always welcoming of people to stop by. And he wound up loaning this group of Hudson Bay paddlers a canoe and a bunch of packs and gear. I mean, so he's, you know, he's all about helping the next generation discover their adventure for themselves and keep the spirit of canoe adventuring alive in the Minnesota and beyond.
All right, thank you so much, Ryan. Ryan's book, Where the Green Light Shines, is through University of Minnesota Press. And right now, Ryan will read an excerpt from his book.
All right. Thanks, Emma. I'll start off reading the beginning of chapter one called Blackwater Song. August 3rd, 1976, Cape Barclay, Arctic Ocean. The night had been miserable. The prior day's wind had harshened into an Arctic gale and carried a deluge of barely liquid rain that pummeled the tent into a wasted stagger. All four of them were crammed inside the tent, which started to leak. To a soundtrack of crashing surf, they'd gone to bed, cold and worried before waking to the awful pattering of frigid water impacting the nylon skins of their already damp sleeping bags. Bob O'Hara slithered out of his bag into his drenched jacket and exited to the Arctic gloaming, where he draped an extra tarp over the tent. The rain came horizontally from the north and stung his face. His cold fingers were cumbersome sausages as he tied knots in the tarp's guy lines. By the time he got back inside, he was soaked. The tent kept leaking. Tom Rice shivered after he'd layered on the last of his clothing, no matter how deeply he burrowed into his sleeping bag. With daybreak, the temperature warmed enough that the four men could sleep. When they finally emerged at 3 p.m., they'd been ensconced for 18 hours. The sea was similar to yesterday, foaming and agitated. The rain turned to snow. In the sea to the north, the route forward, ice appeared. Initially car-sized boulders from last winter's deep freeze that was already finally disintegrating in August. The chunks were followed by looming sheets of pan ice that the wind and seas had sheared off from the open ocean to the north and were cramming down the gullet of the inlet. The men couldn't hear it yet behind the wind and waves, though they soon would. The infinitely layered scritching of ice grinding against the rocky shores. The dejected foursome retreated to the tent. There was nothing to do outside anyway. They were dangerously behind schedule, yet canoeing was certainly not an option. Standing in the wet gobs of falling snow just brought on a chill. That night, the temperature fell below freezing. In the morning, O'Hara didn't know what to do. Ice clogged the sea in both directions. They'd been stuck 3 days already, and the moment he looked outside the tent at the beginning of the fourth, it was obvious they wouldn't be going anywhere again today. A few miles north, at a bottleneck in the inlet, rose a low prominence that might offer better views of the sea. They hiked 4 miles along the coast. The land was treeless, with diminutive tundra plants, bare rock, and endless freshwater ponds. The ptarmigan chicks that fled as they passed were fully grown. Soon they came upon a caribou. O'Hara was accustomed to seeing their scraggly summer coats, but this one was covered in a new layer of rich brown fur, insulation that would keep it alive through the brutal Arctic winter. Fall was knocking and their food supplies were dwindling. Such had been the scenario for multiple tragedies in the north, a lack of time and food prompting risky decisions that backfired in terrible ways. They trekked the tundra to Cape Barclay. What they saw from the summit was ice, not just floating ice like they dodged weeks earlier, but intact shelf ice crammed and mounded and spanning the inlet. Across the inlet, the western shore of the Boothia Peninsula was only 11 miles, though in these conditions it may as well have been 100. To the north, Joa Haven, the tiny Inuit settlement they hoped to reach, sat barricaded by 70 miles of ice. Fall in the Arctic was literal, a gravity-propelled tumble into winter. They had no way of communicating with the outside world, and nobody knew exactly where they were, just that they plied one of the convoluted shores of the 200-mile-deep Chantry Inlet. Eventually, the Mounties would send up a search plane, but no plane could land on the ice-strewn sea, and the land itself was a mess of hillocks and morass. They would have to get themselves out of this, and quickly. At bleak times such as this, when O'Hara felt like crawling into his tent and saying to hell with it all, the person he channeled wasn't one of the battle-proven hardcores he'd cut his teeth with on earlier expeditions, though he'd learned much from them, as had they broadened his, this, in his words, little peon from Minnesota's perception of the world. Rather, it was his mother he looked to, and not because she'd ever set foot in a canoe. She hadn't, and even if she'd been physically able, she wouldn't have seen the point. He looked to his mother because, despite her physical disabilities, she'd lived independently and on her own terms. For her to do this had required a doggedness that struck O'Hara as the epitome of self-determination.
Thank you so much for that excerpt. That was an excerpt from Ryan Rogers' newly released book from the University of Minnesota Press, Where the Green Light Shines, a 50-year odyssey from the boundary waters to the far north. Thank you again, Ryan, for being a guest on Ride on Radio tonight.
Thanks so much for having me, Emma.
Hi, folks. My name is Emma. We are going to be starting the Ride on Radio program here on KFAI 90.3 FM, streaming on live at kfai.org. Today, I have Joseph Whitson and his new book, Marketing the Wilderness, Outdoor Recreation, Indigenous Activism, and the Battle Over Public Lands. Marketing for Wilderness analyzes the relationship between the outdoor recreation industry, public lands in the United States, and Indigenous sovereignty and representation in recreational spaces. Combining social media analysis, digital ethnography, and historical research,
Joseph Whitson
offers nuanced insights into more than a century of outdoor recreation industry's marketing strategies and unraveling its complacency in settler colonialism. Welcome to the show, Joseph.
Thank you, Emma. It's really great to be here.
All right. So I'm just going to start out with the first question is, what inspired you to create this novel and how does it correspond with your research to the university?
Yeah, so this actually comes from two separate kind of inflection points. The first was some jobs that I had right out of undergrad. Mm-hmm. I was working, and I talk about this in a book, but I was working both for Three Rivers Park District, which is a local state-run public lands service here in the Twin Cities. And then I was also working as an Instagram influencer with outdoor recreation companies, some local, some national, doing some writing and photography. And so one of the things that really struck me from that experience was with Three Rivers, we were working closely with Dakota tribes, with the Shakimi Odawakaden, thinking about federal regulation around collaboration and storytelling and making sure we were really responsible about the way we were talking about and narrating public land. I was in the heritage department there. And that's not something we were doing without the recreation. So the original part of the project came out of just trying to understand the blindness that outdoor recreation had towards the history of Indigenous people on the lands that they were using and they were representing. But the second piece came out of the 2017 moment around Bears Ears. And especially, so this is the first Trump administration in kind of a well-publicized attack on public lands and national monuments in particular. And in 2017, we saw this real rapid politicization of the outdoor industry, something we hadn't really seen before. So while I was doing this research, at the same time, we were seeing companies like Patagonia, REI, the North Face, suddenly putting out political statements about their investment in public land, about why it was so important, about what their consumers could do to protect it. And at the same time, there was still this kind of blindness towards Indigenous people. Not always, but the way that it was represented was problematic. And so I kind of realized there wasn't just an ignorance to this colonial history of public lands. There was also an ignorance to the outdoor recreation industry's own complicity in that history. So the book kind of takes up those questions and those thoughts and kind of weaves them into a history of wilderness, public land, and the way that those fit into Indigenous activism and policy.
Phenomenal. That's a great answer. And that's one of the reasons why it kind of like parallels almost my career a little bit too, where as a geologist, my undergrad program actually never really mentioned Indigenous people at all. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of shocking because I graduated with my undergrad degree in 2019. And geology is just absolutely a cornerstone of Indigenous tribes, land management, and everything else. And it just was not brought up anywhere in my degree program, which is fascinating and also very upsetting. But there are movements within certain colleges to try to bring in Indigenous and scientific research to correspond with our own. The next question I have is, your book talks about the concept of wildernessing. Can you elaborate on our listeners on what that means?
Yeah, for sure. So wildernessing is the realization of an idea. It's the way that an idea, this idea that our land is untouched, is pristine, is unpeopled, was made into a reality through policy, through the shaping of behavior. So, for example, you might have a company that represents, and it wasn't just outdoor recreation companies that are part of this process, but this is what it looked like, look at in the book, represent land as having no human history, as you as the consumer being the explorer in this space, being able to see land as it was from the beginning of time. That's not a real representation of the land. These lands have rich, dynamic human histories. They've been shaped by Indigenous people and tribes since time immemorial. But when we have that representation, we get, and people believe it, all of a sudden policy, the Wilderness Act, and the way that people interact and move through space is shaped by that representation and then shapes the land. So wildernessing is the way that wildernesses, which is a constructed concept, came into being through representation and policy.
All right. That's a phenomenal answer for that. So the concept of wildernessing is pretty much baked into the concept of this novel throughout the entire book. The next question I have is, what I love about this book in particular is the pictures of ads and from the late 1800s to the early 1900s, which would have Indigenous folks as like the backdrop. And then towards the 20th century, we have the removal of them completely. And normally for like more recent Patagonia REI ads, you just normally have white guy on a mountaintop. Can you explain the history of that and basically through the marketing experience, why that occurred?
Yeah, that's a big story. Basically, two or three chapters of the book. Yeah. I wanted to narrate the idea that wilderness is not static, right? Today, we think about wilderness in the way I just described it, untouched, uninhabited, pristine, untrammeled is the word that they use. But that's not always how wilderness was understood. And so in the book, I kind of lay out essentially four different versions of wilderness that people went through. This kind of hostile wilderness that was pre-19th century, the wilderness was a scary place. It was a place to be tamed. It was a place to be conquered. But then I start with the book thinking about this idea of a frontier wilderness. And this is a wilderness that is where recreation kind of, in the United States in particular, started with. So we look at companies like Abercrombie and Fitch, which of course we think of as a very different company today than it was in the 1890s. But this is a company that was using this idea of wilderness to sell its products for the first time. But this isn't the wilderness we see today. This is a wilderness that is inhabited. This is a wilderness that is deeply tied to indigenous presence. And I actually want to walk back the idea of indigenous presence. It's a wilderness that's deeply imbued with this idea of Indianness. So kind of a mythologized, romanticized version of indigenous people, but one that doesn't actually have indigenous people in it, because by the 1890s or 20th century, we've kind of moved toward this containment. There had been removal of indigenous people. Their indigenous people were really surveilled and contained to reservations. And so people could go into the wilderness, into these outdoor spaces with their Patagonia or with their Abercrombie and Fitch gear, with this idea of indigenous people, but without actually encountering people to challenge that mythology. But indigenous people or Indianness, authenticized wilderness, and wilderness was wilderness because it had indigenous people in it. That started the change in the mid to late 20th century. And one of the main reasons that changed is because indigenous people were not going to allow that to happen. We see a rise in indigenous activism. We see indigenous self-determination. We see the Indian New Deal. We see this kind of resurgence of indigenous sovereignty and policy in the United States, one that makes it impossible for outdoor recreators to go into the wilderness on public lands and not have their mythologized, romanticized version of what an Indian is challenged. All of a sudden, there were actual indigenous people there to say, no, this isn't what we're contemporary people. We have treaty rights on this land. We're going to fight for these rights. So that version of wilderness just couldn't hold up. So at that time, starting in the 1930s, but through the 40s, 50s, 60s, we see this shift. All of a sudden, wilderness is not a place where you're going to encounter indigenous people. It's a place where indigenous people, in fact, no people have ever been. So you see the Wilderness Society kind of talking about this. You see the roadless laws, and then, of course, culminating in the Wilderness Act, where wilderness is described as land that is untrammeled and untouched by humankind. And then that was made real through these policies, right? So indigenous people were in Yosemite National Park up through the mid-20th century. Indigenous people were present, and actually, you know, there was a military presence to prevent that in Yellowstone National Park. The Boundary Waters here in Minnesota had indigenous people up into the early 20th century. But then when this representation, all of a sudden, that was no longer a benefit, that was no longer a selling point. It was now undermining this new version of wilderness. So you can see how activism, policy, and representation are all kind of playing together to create the wilderness lands we see today.
You can continue. Do you have any other thoughts on that? Or
yeah, I was just going to say, so I mentioned four wildernesses and I had just kind of gone at three. I didn't want to go too long. But the fourth is thinking about the future, right? And so the book kind of ends thinking about the failure and the collapse of our current wilderness ideology. Is it possible to see wilderness today as untouched and untrammeled? And I would say no, partially because we see another resurgence of indigenous activism, specifically looking at outdoor recreation. We saw that at Bears Ears. We see that, you know, on Instagram and some of these accounts that I look at in the book. But also because we have global environmental change, things like global climate change, where places, even Antarctica, places that truly didn't have this human history, you can no longer say those are untouched by humankind, right? These are places that are deeply shaped by the impacts of man. And so the reality of, or the mythology around an untrammeled, untouched wilderness can't hold up anymore. So we're thinking about what is the future of wilderness? Where is this next shift happening? And I kind of go into that a little bit at the end of in the conclusion. But it's, of course, it's not set right now. And the role that the outdoor recreation will play in that kind of has yet to be written.
All right. My follow-up question to that is, I really want to go kind of step back. And when you mentioned recreation, recreation in Minnesota is a huge deal. Boundary Waters employs a lot of outfitters. Cabin culture is a big deal within Minnesota, particularly for mostly folks of like white, middle class, European descent. Most of them have a cabin up north. How does that coincide with recreation and land? And I know rock climbing was a big portion of this book as well, and the example in Yosemite. So can you elaborate on those thoughts that you have on there?
Yeah, I think the interesting, well, I'll start with the rock climbing and kind of think about kind of the Minnesota and the lake life connection, because I think that's really interesting as well. The reason I focus on rock climbing so strongly in the book is because the companies that are most influential in the outdoor recreation space, Patagonia, North Face, Black Diamond, started from rock climbing, in Yosemite rock climbing, from rock climbers, from creating rock climbing gear. So it's kind of that community of climbers and the ethos and ideologies around land that they had that has shaped the way that these outdoor companies represent and advocate for land, right? So rock climbing just has a very strong place in that. We also see kind of contemporary rock climbers, and of course, this isn't everybody in the rock climbing community, but contemporary rock climbers are some of the most resistant to some of the changes that are trying to be put in place around outdoor recreation. So name changes, the idea of you know, creating new runs or kind of bagging new mountains. These have kind of colonial implications behind them. The right to climb where you can and can't climb. It's been difficult for some rock climbing communities to kind of rethink what their place and rights are in nature. So that's one of the reasons rock climbing is way more I could say about that. But for time, I kind of want to re-switch and think about the Minnesota connections here. So I talk about the Boundary Waters. I mean, obviously here in Minnesota, we're very connected to the Boundary Waters. And this is still today with the recent policies and kind of some of the bills that are moving through Congress right now, the Boundary Waters is still on people's mind, right? What is the value of the Boundary Waters? What is the value of recreational land in Minnesota? Can that value of recreational land compete with extraction, compete with the economic value of the minerals that are beneath the soil? And that's a hard argument to make, right? There's so much money to be made by mining. It's going to be challenging to kind of continue to use outdoor recreation alone as a counter to some of those. But I think Minnesota lake life, I think Minnesota's like understanding of kind of this nostalgic connection to land up north. Many of those cabins are carved out of indigenous reservations. They came out through the Dawes Act allotment, when these reservations were sold. And of course, all of it comes through trees that have or have not been fulfilled. So one of the ways I think Minnesotans can think about their relationship to land and the relationship to up north through this lens is to really understand themselves as party to the treaties that created these lands. So we often think about treaties, you know, that ceded the land from indigenous nations to the United States as something that affects indigenous people, right? You know, they're the ones fighting for these treaty rights. They have reserved rights on land. They, you know, the reservations were carved out of that. But those treaties were made by the United States on behalf of us as American citizens, on behalf of us as Minnesotans who have these lands. And so thinking about what does it mean to be a party to these treaties, many of which have not been upheld, in these spaces, when you go up to your cabin, when you go up to the Boundary Waters, when you go to these outdoor spaces, how can you develop more complex relationships to the land? How can you think about supporting indigenous causes or concepts of repatriation in these spaces with the understanding that there was an agreement made beyond just your purchase of that land, but way back with the land being ceded, that you are continue to be a party to? And what are the ethics and responsibilities that you have under that agreement?
Yeah, and that's kind of, it's fascinating. So my family, my father, my grandfather, they do own a cottage in Canada. And it was bought out by the local, it was previously indigenous, white settlers came in. So I do have some understanding of like cottage culture, cabin culture. And it seems like there's always this trend now within cabins where it's like they want almost suburban-like. So like they have more like grass-like front lawns, trees are stripped away. So it's almost like taking that American suburban landscape and then just plotting it onto the lake up north, which does mess up the ecosystem and the shorelines. And it does not respect the land itself, mostly.
Right. It's a very colonial shaping of that space, right? In a different way than wilderness is, of course, which is, of course, removing the idea or removing the presence of humans. The cabin culture and the kind of private ownership of lakes, of lakefront and vacation homes reshapes that land for colonial purposes at the expense of indigenous uses, even when treaties, you know, protect certain rights and uses of that land. It's made impossible through the kind of shaping of those spaces.
Yeah, I did have a question about when writing this book and consulting Native indigenous thoughts, what was that like working with those folks? What kind of feedback did you get? What did you learn? Anything new, anything challenging from your preconceived notions? I just want to understand that process a little bit better.
Yeah. So as, you know, if you don't know, I'm a white male, you know, settler scholar, and working, you know, with indigenous people is always going to be a challenge and a work for self deconstruction, right? And so just kind of approaching those spaces with humility and understanding that, you know, you don't necessarily know what's going on. You want to be able to like elevate the voices of the people who have the knowledge of these spaces. And so think about like, what is my, is a white person's role in this, right? I'm, you know, there's folks doing really great activism work that I don't necessarily need to insert myself into. But there's also audiences that aren't being reached, right? So to think about my role as a scholar and a writer as being kind of a translator and bringing some of these, you know, issues, indigenous people don't need to be told that there's an indigenous history of this land, right? Indigenous people don't need to be told that there is 150 years or longer of really important indigenous activism efforts that have shaped policy and continue to shape the land. But outdoor recreators do, right? Geologists do, right? All the ways that like we, you know, we as white people kind of encounter and learn about outdoor space and the environment, that's not part of the curriculum. And there's a reason that's not part of the curriculum, right? It's part of the colonial project. So to be able to uplift these stories and bring, you know, these voices, these activists, and also my own analysis to a larger audience is kind of the way that I saw my work within these communities. But it's shaped the way I see land. It's shaped the way I see kind of communities, even urban spaces, right? To have had conversations and had kind of been deeply embedded with some of these, not that, you know, online, right? How deep can we be online? That's a different question. But involved or in conversation with some of these activists and communities, you really can't approach any land the same way. I mean, I think that's really important. And it really kind of shapes the way that my relationship with land has evolved and hopefully the way that all outdoor recreators' relationships with land can evolve.
Yeah, that was the one takeaway, big thing from this book was how do I interact with the land? And like in our degree programs, particularly, we do market our degree very similar to the way Patagonia REI market their outdoor supplies. It's like, hey, come do our geology degree, come market our environmental science degree. And I absolutely remember in my undergrad program, there was just a picture of the Tibetan mountains, and it was a picture of one of our students, all white, cisgendered, male-bodied, out in like a very indigenous area, but with like no mention of indigenous landscapes. So I'm really hoping that this book forces me to realize the type of land that I research on, where did it come from, and how to properly respect it, which is not something that's really common in my field, unfortunately. I do want to touch a bit on the last chapter, indigenizing Instagram, and like the current social movements towards reclaiming land and spaces. And I wonder if you can elaborate more on that.
Yeah, so I think that's a great chapter to be read kind of in alongside chapter 4, which is about the strategies, the digital strategies that outdoor companies have adopted. And this is before AI, right? You know, which came around so quickly, you know, between the publication and production of the book, you know, you can't even get some of these new things in. But the way that like digital photography and social media and digital spaces have been taken up by outdoor marketing to kind of reinforce their ideas. Well, chapter 6, which is indigenizing Instagram, looks at the way that indigenous people and activists have taken up those same strategies to push against these narratives. And the way that Instagram at this moment, of course, that's changing. Instagram is no longer the place it was in 2017, but hopefully new platforms that come up our flattening spaces, right? Our places that activists can speak to power and have a more direct line to the people who are making these decisions than they might have had under a traditional media landscape. So we look at, we look at the ways that some of these activists are taking up strategies of like influencers, right? So having Indigenous athletes be influencers who can talk about their own relationships and their own connections to land through outdoor recreation or through other means, in the way that outdoor companies will have influencers and athletes to talk about their maybe less critical or more colonial relationships to land. Or we have digital first communities, right? So we think about our relationship to companies. You know, we buy stuff, and but a lot of these are digital, are through our consumption of digital media. So Indigenous people, like, for example, Jolie Varela of Indigenous Women Hike, creating a digital community of activists who are all working kind of towards a goal of pushing against these narratives of wilderness that the outdoor companies are putting forward, and then moving towards physical and embodied activism, right? So it's this kind of switch that we saw from kind of early digital activism, which was bringing in digital spaces, physical spaces into digital spaces, but creating digital communities and moving them into physical communities. So I don't know, personally for me, I think it speaks to the ways that Indigenous activists are very good at adapting to power structures, something that we've seen, you know, for 100 years, all sorts of under different levels of surveillance and power structures and containment. Social media has its drawbacks, of course, as an activist space. It's private. It can be censored. We see all these things happening today. And yet Indigenous activists have experience and knowledge about how to counteract that and how to move through these very highly controlled spaces in order to push for change.
Perfect. All right. Joe, my last kind of question, it's in your book. You wrote out a phenomenal answer that I would love for you to read out. It's at the very end of it's the last couple of paragraphs within the book. The question is, we can't turn back the clock on colonialization. So what does moving forward look like? If you want to read the rest of that excerpt.
For sure. Yeah. So this is a really important question. So thank you for asking. I probably don't have a satisfying answer to it, but I want to try. I think the focus needs to be less about stewing on past wrongs and more about how to justly move forward. The pervasiveness and long history of colonization, however, doesn't mean the consequences of these actions don't still impact different groups of people today. And the inability to perfectly restore things to how they were doesn't absolve us of the responsibility to justly address these past wrongs. In some instances, this can mean addressing specific past events. Like in the United States, we can uphold specific legally binding treaties that have been broken or pay for known thefts of land and property, Fourth Amendment takings, for example. But you are also right that this is not possible everywhere and cannot address longer histories of colonialism and genocide. So instead of just accepting this and saying, I guess this is the way things are now, we move forward justly. What I mean by justice here is that we work to restore right relationships among different groups of people. And yes, to your point about taking land from animals, which was another question that came up earlier, between people and the natural world. Right relationships are built on respect, reciprocity, equality, and self-determination. While this seems easy, just an everyone be nice and love each other kind of thing, the problem is that it's actually pretty radical. It's radical on an individual level with people, especially white people like myself, having to address internalized racism and colonial worldviews. And it is radical on a political and social level. How would American society have to change if we seriously accepted the idea that all people are inherently valuable and non-exploitable, and the natural world is not a commodity, but a partner to us that we need to respect and give to as much as we take from? With regards to repatriation, sometimes this means land back in a Western property ownership way. Other times it means political jurisdiction, or in the recent Oklahoma case, sometimes it means full co-management like at Bears Ears. But in all cases, on all land, it means a fundamental realignment of a relationship with land and with each other, from a colonial one that treats land as a commodity to be owned and exploited to one that treats land, animals, and humans as connected community. You asked, what is the solution? The answer is that there isn't a great one under our current political, economic, and social systems, because these systems were built on the exploitation of land and people. I see public lands as a place where we can begin rebuilding relationships and trust, but it has to start by addressing this history, acknowledging the contemporary consequences of it, and working together to imagine what a more just future looks like.
Thank you so much, Joseph Winston, for that last bit of reading. For those listeners just tuning in, that was Joseph Winston and his new book, Marketing the Wilderness, Outdoor Recreation and Indigenous Activism and the Battle Over Public Lands.
Thank you for tuning in to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM. My name is Emma, and I would like to thank our special guests tonight. If you wish to follow up on more updates, please follow us on Instagram at Right on KFAI. I'm hoping to launch a website later this fall and hopefully maybe get a little email listserv going on just for more, just to spread the Right on word. And I'm really excited.